Good morning. It is 10 minutes past 8 o'clock here on Broken Road Radio. And along with us, David Allen Punt, the news guy for Broken Road, and Doug Greenwald, Preserving Bible Times. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Well, we're doing fine here. A few technical problems. A few, those software kinds of glitches. Dave had some problems gathering the news today, but he persevered, and he took control of his technology and came through with a newscast right on time. I was so impressed, David.
Well, thanks so much.
He wrestles with mice and with keyboards and and rebooting this and turning that on and off, and he just does wonders over there.
Just about to go out and get a newspaper.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about the Jewish Mind of Jesus Day today, along with Doug, and there's some huge issues involved, but we always like to start with your quote for the Broken Road. What's your quote for the day?
Well, the quote that sort of came to my mind today, and I'll try to backfill it a little bit after I give it, but it goes like this. There is no substitute for reading the Bible in context. It throws a great deal of light on the commentaries. And the reason that's one of my favorites is when I got into teaching, the Bible very unexpectedly back in 1978, when a pastor came to me after seeing my spiritual gift profile that I had done in a workshop and said, teaching, wisdom, knowledge, and some form of discernment here, I tell you what, in 2 weeks, you start teaching the graduate students at Michigan State University. I suggest you start with the Gospel of John, and if you need any help, let me know.
If you need any help, yeah.
Right. So, other than panic, which I think what anyone would have done, I decided to race down to my local Christian bookstore, and I bought 10 commentaries on the Gospel of John. And if I mention 6 or 8 of those names, you would know them. Very well known. And so I taught the next 3 years on a cut and paste method of what I thought was the best of each of their stuff. And after 3 years, we were halfway through the 5th chapter of John. And I realized that I didn't need to be in a hurry. And I like to have time to take that rosebud and allow it to open in the spirit to be a full-blown rose. But anyway, fast forward another 25 or 30 years. I woke up about 4 or 5 years ago with the following realization. As far as I could tell, as I hearkened back, there were no indications that any of the 12 commentaries that I had been using way back then, that any of those commentators had ever walked the land or showed a particular insight into the context, the culture, the geography, the climate, the geology of the land. And so I sort of have my own little personal yardstick now that I use for commentaries, and that I try to find out as fast as I can, does this particular commentator indicate that they are aware of the cultural, literary, geographical, historical, contextual issues and the visual issues of the particular passages or narratives that they're commenting on? And if they do, then they're going to enter into my library. Now, please let me be clear here. It doesn't mean that those first 12 commentaries on John that I bought, that there was anything wrong with them. They were not full of error or contained error. But on the other hand, they didn't necessarily see the whole picture either. And so that's why I've always sort of fancied that quote that I opened up with this morning, there's no substitute for reading the Bible in context. It throws a great deal of light on the commentaries.
You know, something that strikes me about that is it seems kind of inside out, reading the Bible throwing light on the commentaries. Isn't it supposed to be the other way around?
Well, it is. And of course, you know, most of the commentaries we read come with an inherent Western bias. They're generally written by Western authors who probably are deep into Western Greek Hellenistic thinking without even realizing it. And if they've not had the opportunity to walk the land or to immerse themselves in it one way or another, there's probably some things that they're just not seeing or appreciating. It's not that what they're saying is wrong. It's sometimes it just isn't the wide-angle lens that some passages really are richly understood with.
David, you had a question for Doug this morning.
Well, I just had another question. I mean, I've heard that I have a Western-shaped mind before, and I've never really understood what that meant. What would without, you know, maybe this sounds like a sidetrack, but what is an Eastern mind, or what is a non-Western mind, or I'm not even sure of the right term. What does that include?
Well, if you didn't know better, you'd think that was a setup segue into our topic, perhaps for today and for a few more sessions to come. But let's start with one observation. As a Westerner, we are typically into form. A Middle Easterner is all about function. So if I were to hold up my little scripto ballpoint pen in my hand here, and I would show it to you, and I would say, describe this, you'd say, well, it's long and narrow, it's cylindrical, it's tapered at one end, it appears to have some stainless steel on it. You're describing the form of the pen. If I showed this to a first century Hebrew, he'd say, oh, that's a pen. So that's a very, very significant distinction of form versus function, because function is about doing. Function is about behavior. And to the Hebrew mind, God is what God does. And so when you read the Old Testament, that's a very, very helpful way to read it, to look at it, to understand it. God is what God does. And what you will notice is that God seldom says in the narrative, except perhaps for the Psalms in the Old Testament, I am your provider. But what you see him doing is providing for his people consistently. Seldom does God come right out and say, I am your defender. But what you see is God defending his people century after century. So this difference of form versus function is a very, very real one, because we tend to read the scriptural record through form eyes, and yet it's meant to be understood through function eyes. It's about behavior. And so that's probably contrast number one.
Does that mean that we tend to be, as Westerners, analytical, where we need not be? We just automatically lapse into that thing?
That's certainly a corollary of that. The Middle Eastern, the Near Eastern worldview is all about synthesis, keeping things together. The Western Greek mind is all about analysis and tearing things apart. And so we'll look at God in the scriptures, and in our systematic theology, we will identify 15, 16, 17 attributes of God. That's a very Western way of thinking. The Jew of the Bible never approaches God that way. We see that in our understanding of, say, shalom. To the Greek, shalom is peace with God, or reconciliation with God, reconciliation with the community, then reconciliation with yourself, then reconciliation with God's creation. There's actually four aspects to shalom. Well, you notice how the Greek first, right off the bat, wants to tear it apart into four pieces? But the Hebrew mind would never approach it that way. Hebrew mind is all about keeping things together. Fusion, synthesis. And so it would see those four threads of shalom as interwoven into a cord of a rope that is inseparable. And so we have a lot of automatic ways of doing things that we've been trained to think that aren't the way they think in the Bible. That help, David?
Yeah, it does. It helps quite a bit. And you know, I've got a couple thousand more questions about the peace talks in Israel. You know, and just about everything else that we tend to think differently.
The question there, Dave, that I would like to ask right now is does that same distinction hold true in the modern day? In other words, those people in charge of Israel, are they Western minded, or are they truly of the Middle Eastern mindset?
Well, let's take another aspect. There are probably 20 of them that separate the Western Hellenistic 21st century mind from the world of the Middle East even today. And that is that the community is always more important than the individual in the Bible and in the Middle East today. Well, nothing could be further from the truth here in the West, where the individual is always more important than the community. And just that one distinction right there shapes tremendously how we read the words of Scripture. It even helps us really understand the Middle Eastern world today. You know, I think we in the West are really puzzled by suicide bombers. I mean, why would a person ever want to do such a thing, give up your life? But if you realize that the outcome of the community is always more important than whatever happens to an individual, you begin to get into their mindset and into their way of thinking. And this carries over into the Bible. Remember in Luke 11, there's this, what some have thought was this puzzling parable about a visitor who shows up at a village at midnight. And there's this red alert scramble to prepare a full-fledged meal. And Middle Eastern protocol requires that more food and drink be put on the table than this person could possibly ever eat or drink. And it's midnight. And so this one person goes to a certain door. And we think he knocks, although he speaks when you read the text carefully. And when we start to identify with this parable, we identify with the person at the door, because in our Western way of thinking, we say, aha, he's got a problem. He needs to find food and drink for his newly arrived friend. But what we fail to understand is, no, the community has a problem, because the community's honor is at stake here. And unless the community rallies to provide food and drink and everything that goes with that for this newly arrived guest, the honor of the village will be shamed. And that helps us explain why the person at the door knows why the person inside is going to respond. You know, we've often called this something to do with persistent prayer. Well, there's nothing persistent going on in that parable at all. In that incident, the person at the door is simply making the request known. Once the person inside knows about the request, he is honor-bound to fulfill it, and to fulfill it with more than is being requested for, which is some bread. And so the Middle Eastern person hearing that story of Jesus immediately identifies with the person inside the house who has the capacity to meet the need of this person, this visitor, and therefore the village. So this notion of individual versus community is a huge one, and just this simple pair of glasses, changing those two lenses, will often change how we read and understand many passages in the Gospels.
Doing that, though, actually doing that, stepping out of your ingrained mindset and patterns of thought, that's a tall order.
Well, it's a tall order, but it's not as difficult as you might think. The problem here is we never really think about the way we think.
Mm-hmm.
We never have to. And once somebody shows you a different way to think, and you see it illustrated 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times, it's pretty easy to appropriate that pair of glasses and to use it, and to start to understand the mindset of a Middle Eastern villager in the first century. I don't think it's done in 5 minutes, but some of the things we've done at Preserving Bible Times here is we've summarized these different traits. There are probably about 20 of them in a compare and contrast table, so that you can sort of use it as a cheat sheet to get up to speed pretty quickly. But once you see it, you see it. But until it's shown to you, you don't even realize it's an issue.
I've been reading Matthew lately, and I find it difficult to do, disturbing, the way it's laid out. And I'm wondering if this Eastern versus Western mindset has something to do with that. I mean, maybe I'm having trouble stepping out of that, but it seems to jump from topic to topic to topic, and I have the feeling that it's really not, that there are threads there tying it all together that I just don't perceive. As we read Scripture, we have to be able to adopt, apparently, that Middle Eastern mindset to really get full meaning out of this, to squeeze every drop of understanding that we can out of Scripture. Matthew was, or Levi, was a Jew, a tax collector, who had kind of gone over to the other side, in a sense, and maybe wrote with a certain perspective. Luke, on the other hand, a Greek, who wrote both Luke and Acts, and I'm very comfortable with those. That there seems to be a pattern of thought there I can relate to. Is that mindset difference?
Well, let's take a look at the four Gospels, because they are indeed very different. When we deal with Matthew, we're primarily focusing on the words of Jesus. When we deal with Mark, we're primarily dealing with the actions of Jesus. When we deal with Luke, we're primarily dealing with the chronology of Jesus. And when we deal with the Gospel of John, we're primarily dealing with the conflicts of Jesus. One of the things I like about Luke is it's the best chronological flow of the life of Jesus, because he is a Greek, and he's pretty much putting his narrative together that way. When we deal with the other three writers who are Jewish, we have to get out of our Western way of thinking here about sequence, because a Jew is not necessarily into sequence when it comes to narrative construction. A Jew is simply trying to put together some thoughts in a flow. And if they have to move some of the incidents around chronologically, no big deal, because the Jewish mind is not into sequence. Only we in the West here are into sequence. So that's one distinction right there, I think, that sometimes you have to bring to the reading of the Gospels. And secondly, this issue of submission to the authority of our rabbi is a difficult one for Westerners. We want to pick and choose, and we want to say, yeah, I like that. Oops, that's kind of difficult. Oh my, that seems impossible. And so that's how we implicitly oftentimes work our way through the passage. But to a first century disciple who hears these words of Jesus, submission is not the issue. It may be difficult to do, but your willingness to submit to it is never in play. And so I think that's part of the tension and the ambiguity that often we Westerners bring to some of the hard teachings of Jesus, and it's all in this implicit worldview area.
And that explains why I'm having some bumpy roads in Matthew, I think. And you read of events like the wedding at Cana, back to back with his overthrowing the money changers' tables in the temple. When I think that happened far apart, that the money changers thing happened as he approached Jerusalem just prior in Passion Week, right?
Well, there is a lot of energy that has been expended from the commentary perspective of are there actually two incidents of Jesus entering the temple and throwing out the money changers, or are there just one? And from a Western perspective, that's analytically how they like to think. But when you adopt this Jewish way of thinking, it's not a big deal whether it occurred at the beginning or at the end. That incident is useful for developing the thought process, the sequencing that John himself wants to develop. And so it doesn't matter to a Jew whether this is the same event repeated twice or whether these are two separate events. The issue is, where is it in the flow and what's the message that comes with it?
Something to keep in mind, but it's going to be a tall order again, I think, to try to maintain that other point of view, looking through those other lenses as we read. But very important, and you've taught me that in the past, because so many scriptures just come to life when you do step out of your normal mindset and understand what's going on like that. Let's go back to a little bit about the history of the Pharisees and the rabbis. And I'm thinking the full scope of the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. When did rabbis start? They've been around forever. Are they all Pharisees or all Pharisees rabbis? Or I know the Pharisees as a party, as an element, got their start during the Hasmonean dynasty back to 100 or the first century, maybe to the second century BC. How does a Pharisee relate to a rabbi?
Well, let's back it up a little bit and see if we can trace the evolution of the Pharisee movement and why it evolved, and I think that will be helpful to us, and we can do that very quickly. When Alexander the Great in 332 BC entered this land, for the very first time, Greek thought and Western philosophy, if you will, entered this Middle Eastern world. And after about 130 years of that, Greek philosophy had created a crisis in Judaism, because Greek philosophy is about ideas. It's conceptual, and as we've already earlier, the Jewish mind is very concrete. It's about function. It's about behavior. It's not into ideas and concepts. If a Greek said to a Jew, you know, God is omniscient and omnipresent, you would just befuddle a Hebrew. All he knows is that God is his protector, his defender, his provider, because God is what God does. So after 130 years or so of this, there's a crisis in Judaism, and the young men in Judaism are beginning to desert the faith in droves because of the perceived superiority of Greek philosophy and Greek thinking. Judaism is not particularly a philosophical religion. And this created a crisis. I mean, how was the covenant of Abraham going to be carried on if all the young men are bailing out of the faith? And so a small group got together and created what we know as the Pharisaic movement. And their original purpose was to be the evangelist of their day, to call the Jewish young men back to the faith. I mean, there was everything about it was honorable and laudable and to be commended. And as often happens, and we've certainly seen it in the last 100 years here in mainline Protestant denominations, the theology starts to drift. And the theology began to drift in Phariseeism. And so by the time we get to Jesus, there's some implicit, sometimes even explicit, we'll call it Pharisaic theology in place, is that there are some people that we just know God doesn't like. And the rabbis have started to promulgate different ways and different rulings, authoritative rulings that determine who God doesn't like. And they are people who have birth defects, people who are born blind, people who are in certain unclean professions like shepherding and tanning, people who are in tax collectors and prostitutes, people who are lepers, people who are childless, like Elizabeth in Luke 1. And their theology has evolved to the point that we know God doesn't like these people because of the maladies that they exhibit. They wouldn't have these issues if God really liked them. And since we are all about honoring God, we're not going to like them either. In fact, the more we scorn them, the more we're honoring God. That's how twisted the system had become over 150 years. And so I would suggest that's part of why Jesus came. He had to turn this system around. And now that's a very helpful backdrop to his Luke 4 reconstruction of Isaiah 61, when he says that he has come to set the prisoners free. He has come, among other things, to bring compassion and mercy. God's always intended compassion and mercy, if you go back into Leviticus, for those who now have been systematically deprived of it by the religious establishment, and they've been deprived of it in the name of God. The whole thing is turned upside down. So
Another factor in this, would it not be that the Levitical priesthood was long gone from Israel? They were now in Egypt after the Babylonian captivity, and they were gone. The true priesthood was not there. A vacuum. Doug, did we lose you? I think we did. We're going to see if we can fix this and get back to our talk with Doug Greenwald. Doug, are you there? Assure me that you're there.
Well, Jim, I'm doing my best to be here.
You look like you're there. We were in the middle of a terrific discussion, and we were talking about the origin of the Pharisees and how they came together would you have called it a political party? I mean, it was political and religious were the same thing back then, weren't they?
So many things are fused into one. It certainly was a religious movement. I think we could say that. They were really anti-politics, a major part of them, of what was going on in Jerusalem as well. So I'd use the word political carefully.
And this was just before the Romans really took hold there, right?
Yeah, the Romans came in 63 BC, and the Pharisees really started their movement. It's a little iffy, but somewhere in the 170 BC timeframe.
And I was suggesting when we lost contact that there was a vacuum there because the Levitical priesthood had fled to Egypt at the time, and that's not something I know much about. I'm not sure much is written about that. Maybe archaeology can bring us some information about that period, but didn't that leave kind of a vacuum in Israel as far as established religion?
Well, the Zadokite priesthood, which traced themselves to Zadok, who was the high priest during David's time, had continued to be in the high priesthood up until probably the Hasmonean Judas the Maccabee revolt period of time. And one of the flaws in the Hasmonean dynasty, when Jews started to govern Jews again in roughly 164 BC, is the Hasmoneans merged the high priesthood with the kingship, and that had never happened before in Israel, and that started the demise of the high priesthood in terms of its authority and in terms of its integrity. And by the time we get to Jesus, we have the high priesthood basically being a franchise that you buy from Rome, and you make annual payments to Rome to keep your high priesthood. So, yeah, the corruption of the high priesthood really traces itself to about the 170, 160 time frame here, when the Zadokite priesthood just had enough of this desire of the Hasmoneans to fuse the high priesthood with kingship, and they just left and set up shop in Egypt.
Would it be fair to say that the high priesthood then had become secularized by Jesus' time?
You pick the words: secularized, corrupted, profoundly disconnected from spiritual, religious dimensions and values historically in the faith. These are probably as most ruthless businessmen, if you will, running what I like to call Temple Inc., the Wall Street of its day down in Jerusalem, running several businesses out of the temple, some of which are very corruptly run, like money changing and animal selling. These leadership, it's a combination of Jerusalem Pharisees and a handful of Sadducean elite families, are a total vacuum when it comes to spirituality. They're as corrupt as the day is long, and what's interesting is everybody knows it. Now, when we say the high priesthood, we have to differentiate between the ordinary priesthood, of which there are anywhere from 12,000 to 20,000 of the Zacharias of that era, who are at work doing all of the infrastructure issues, sacrifices and wood and incense burning and what have you, keeping the temple running. They're really good people, but it's the high priesthood that's totally corrupt at the time of Jesus.
Now, would it be fair to compare that secularization of established of the religious establishment to perhaps the modern day trend within some circles of evangelicalism to commercialize and lose the spiritual aspect of it? I mean, have we seen that in some form repeated in the modern day?
You know, Jim, I'm not going to walk through that door. It would be an interesting discussion, but it's not as clean as all that. There was just a total void of spirituality in the temple at the time of Jesus. It's totally and willfully corrupt. Everybody knows it. And I'm not sure I want to go into any analogies or extrapolations to contemporary situations.
Well, we started with a question. My question is a rabbi necessarily a Pharisee or vice versa? I mean, how did Pharisees make a living? I mean, aside from the corrupt ones and the involvement with church businesses, we kind of know how their palms were greased. But what do they do day to day? Did they have day jobs?
Some of them were tradespeople. Some of them were just peasant farmers. But what distinguished them was their knowledge of the law and their zeal and their commitment. I mean, two things we have to realize is that there's a wide diversity in Phariseeism. The northern Pharisees are really rather different from the southern Pharisees. And then when you deal with the southern Pharisees, the Pharisees that are in cahoots with the Sadducees running the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court in Jerusalem, are yet a different animal than the remainder of the southern Pharisees. And then when we go up north, we have the ordinary Pharisees, and then we have a special group called the Hasidim, the miracle-working Pharisee rabbis of the north, of which I would suggest that's how Jesus was initially viewed in his ministry. And so it was true then, and it's true now. There's tremendous diversity in Judaism, and we never can paint Phariseeism with one paintbrush. It's not one size fits all.
And we will look more into that as we rejoin Doug this time next week. Hopefully, Doug, we can get you back next Wednesday morning and kind of pick up where we leave off this morning.
Look forward to that.
This is fascinating. And again, I thank you very much for your time and for your wisdom and your skill in presenting it. And we will look forward to talking with you again next Wednesday. Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times, a ministry in the Washington, D.C. area. You can learn more about Doug and about his ministry at preservingbibletimes.org. It's a world of resources for your church, for your Bible studies and small groups. Be an awfully good website to bookmark in your browser and visit them often. Doug, thank you. Have a terrific day.
Thanks, Jim. Shalom.